everyone. It's Monday, December 9th. It's wet out there, and it's going to be even wetter tomorrow and maybe up to 50. What is this? This is like the striped weather. It's what they talk about in Minnesota.
Striped?
Yeah. It's like you go every couple of feet, it gets different, you know? Anyway, you're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arnison and producer Ken Barnes. So before you tell me about what's up, you know, what's floating your boat, I went to a high Scottish tea to help fund the little tiny library in Nottingham last night. It was only 30 people. They had Scottish music. The food was remarkable. I mean, every sort of Scottish sandwich and Scottish sweet and four different kinds of teas. And they gave us little, you know, little crowns to wear. It was so adorable. And the library, everyone, is the size of a little cottage. That's the library in Nottingham. So they're raising money for their little library. So the whole atmosphere was just... It just made you smile. And you really kind of love small town New England because everybody was hugging each other and loving each other and smiling about what they baked. And it was and we ate on good china. We ate on good. It wasn't paper. It was fine china. So nice. That's what I did last night. I had
Scottish
tea. Yeah, it's lovely. I suddenly realized what I can do with my china. I should have a tea. Oh, well, maybe next year a tea. All right, darling. So what are we talking about on this December 9th?
Couple of things, Arnie. One, and they're both related to foreign countries, because I know you're going to spend a lot of time domestic issues today.
Well, no, we'll talk about Ukraine, too, I'm sure.
Okay. Do you know that it's only this Thursday? It's coming right up when the British are going to have an election.
Brexit. Oh, the election. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which will actually – yeah, you're right. You're right. It's going to be wild.
And it's crazy, you know, they've got – I was actually surprised because I saw this picture of the candidates debating. And it looks like our Democratic debate. There's not 10 of them, but there's maybe 8 of them or 6 of them.
But they represent different parties as opposed to lots of different parties.
Yeah. Obviously, Boris Johnson, the Brexit guy, and he's running against the even harder Brexit guy, Nigel Farage. And, and the Labour Party has Jeremy Corbyn, who people are saying is a horrible anti-Semitic.
He's off the rails completely.
There's a Liberal Democratic Party that used to actually have some weight and be in the middle of the Tories and the Labour and be part of various coalitions. Governments when necessary. There's a Scottish party that wants Scottish.
They're concerned. They wanted to break away anyway, so it's not surprising there's a Scottish party.
Well, that's the thing that they, you know, they have a position on Brexit that the other two are courting, but they also want to break away from the British government altogether. Well, they want to leave the UK.
Well, and if they if the UK ends up, you know, going through with this Brexit, they have every reason to do it because it almost passed last time. It almost passed.
Right. And then from Northern Ireland,
oh my God,
they have unionists who want to keep Northern Ireland part of UK, and nationalists that want to have just one Irish country with the South and not be part of the UK.
Democracy is framed, and
they're all complicated because the Brexit issue kind of cuts across party or national, if you will, issues among
you can't
the
make an assumption that there's
UK
that there's
nations,
a good side and a bad side or a right side and the wrong side because
the voters within each separate country are going to be torn between do I vote for my Scottish party because it wants to secede from the UK or
stay in the EU. You know, oh my God, it is.
Yeah, it's really pretty wild. It's pretty wild. Then the other thing that I wanted to talk about is, once again, Donald Trump has made a speech about Jews that has just been criticized.
You mean the real estate Jews in New York? Is that what you're referring to, his comments?
It's unbelievable. You know, there are so many members of the Republican Party and Democratic Party who criticized Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib for criticizing Israeli policy towards the Palestinians.
Which we all criticize.
Democratic. Yeah, I call them anti-Semitic tropes and everything. And here's this guy, the president of the United States, saying unbelievable things.
Do you have the quote exactly? Because I just want to remind everyone that his Orthodox son-in-law, Jared, is also in the real estate business.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if he's the exception to the rule. But people need to hear. I mean, he is such – He's disgusting.
Yeah, he characterized Jews as driven by money. He said they're not sufficiently loyal to Israel. And then he has the chutzpah, if you will, to say that you Jews have no choice but to support me because I'm the only one that's here recommending increased support for Israel. So what did he say? Yes, I have
anywhere.
The exact quote. A lot
right,
of yeah. you are in the real estate business because I know
this.
You very well. You're brutal killers, not nice people at all, but you have to vote for me. You have no choice.
Gosh.
And he went on to talk about
He's
a certain senator from Massachusetts. You're not going to vote for Pocahontas. You're not going to vote for the wealth tax. Yeah, let's take 100% of your wealth away. We have to get the people of our country, of this country, to love Israel more. We have to get them to love Israel more because you have people that are Jewish people, that are great people, and they don't love Israel enough.
He's
really blatantly anti-Semitic, saying
he's
that
anti-everyone but himself. It's so universal. Who does he love?
People. You're brutal killers.
But who does he love? He loves no one but himself.
Me.
Yes. Please understand, everyone is worthy of being trampled on. Everyone is called a killer. Everyone is evil. He is the only one. He is the only one. I mean, the level of, oh, my God, he's a megalomaniac.
Yeah, but some of his prior anti-Semitic comments were more
nuanced,
toned down, at least. You have to know something to know that they're anti-Semitic tropes. But this, to say that you Jews are real estate people, and I know you very well, and you're brutal killers. Oh, my God.
Yeah, but Ken,
are you kidding me?
He's gotten away with everything, Ken. Why would he not go over the top? There's nothing to rein him in. He has been successful at everything, and he has a blind following that gives him license to be more harsh, to be more evil, to be more brutal. He has been given a license to behave the way you see this. That's what's so unbelievable.
Right. But, of course, the key about this statement is not just that he has a license to say what he wants, but that what he wants to say is so brutally racist.
What isn't? What does
you
he
Jews
say?
You Jews are brutal killers.
Oh my! I mean,
you're
it's,
horrible
he
people.
Is, he's app. He's,
I mean,
he's
come on.
He's kind of he is shocking. He is shocking. And what is so depressing is nothing shocks anymore. That's what's depressing is that he is so wild. And that's one of the reasons why it's going to be very difficult to even talk about impeachment, because impeachment looks almost passive compared to all the other behaviors he's exhibited. Let's be honest here.
Yeah.
The fact that he wants to shake down the Ukrainian president seems to pale in comparison to absolutely everything else he has done. I mean, that it's absolutely true. You know, I mean, look what he did to the Kurds. The Kurds. Look at the murder he's committed on the Kurds. You're worried about corruption and Biden. I am totally offended by what he did to the Kurds. Mm-hmm. I mean, oh, my God, how is that not at the top of the charts when it comes to – but you know why we can't impeach him on that? Because that's a foreign policy decision, and you are allowed to make mistakes.
Well, I don't know about that kind of mistakes.
Well, yeah, I don't disagree with you, but that is part of the rationale is that you can't – that's a policy blunder and not a corruption blunder. And I'm thinking that policy blunder has a lot to do with corruption. I think they're threaded together.
We could wonder whether the other shoe's going to drop, and it turns out that he's building a Trump Tower in Turkey.
I think he is, but it's more than that. It's what Putin wants. I mean, this is all the Putin agenda. This is all the mm-hmm. Putin agenda, and Trump is just basically, you know, his aide de camp. You know, if he's an aide de camp, and that means Putin must have so much on him.
Right.
Putin must have files and files and bodies and sex and money and loans. He must have so much on him that the only person that Trump fears is Putin. Nobody else on the planet. I'm telling you. It's depressing. All right. So this is our Rethink the Week. Unbelievable. So I have a couple of things. So, you know, I'm the atheist that goes to church. So I went to church on Sunday, and my minister did a prayer. But there was a line in his prayer that I wrote down as he was saying it because I thought it was so powerful. And I actually posted it on Facebook. I see Dean Spiliota showing up right now. So Dean's going to get to hear what I had done. So in his prayer, he's praying for our political leaders, okay, for the leaders of our country. And he says that he prays that they will embrace virtue over victory and truth over ticket. That is really good. Virtue over victory and truth over ticket. So I thought that was pretty impressive. So I posted that on Facebook, and then I am now sharing it with you on The Attitude. And then, Dean Spiliotis, did you get my email this morning about my tweet?
I saw your tweet.
Wasn't that good? I thought that I'm glad. Dean Spiliotis is with us. He is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University. He has a blog, nhpoliticalcapital.com, and he also is a regular on New Hampshire Public Radio. I, by the way, did WGBH this weekend, and I did a show called Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. And I get to cover all those, like, New Hampshire stories and Maine stories and Vermont stories. I cover all those little teeny tiny states.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah, well, actually, it is interesting stuff. Yeah. There was a lot of stuff that we could talk about. But on the New Hampshire piece, Dean, I just want to comment on this because it is a tragic, tragic statistic. New Hampshire is a very wealthy state, and but we rank either number one or number 50 on so many issues. We rank number 50 when it comes to state aid to education. We rank number 50 when it comes to state aid to higher education. We rank number one when it comes to higher ed student debt. You know, we vacillate. But this was a statistic that I thought was really over the top. It turns out that in the last decade, the state that had the highest percentage of deaths of people between the ages of 24 and 35 was New Hampshire. Did you see that story? It was an NPR story.
Okay? We've been covering the opiate crisis for a long time.
Well, but this isn't a specific story. But this was not opioids per se. This was just generically looking at 25 to 35, looking at all 50 states, and the highest percentage increase in deaths in the United States.
In general, not opioids.
In general.
It could be suicide, it could be accidents, anything.
It could be anything.
Yeah.
And it was absolutely shocking, this number. And one of the things that was said in the NPR story, and then I'll bring my other two guests who are now very patiently waiting online by phone, was that, well, you know, it's because of opioids, it's because of depression, it's because of obesity. And they went through this whole reason why New Hampshire was like could be number one with its highest percentage increase. And I said on WGBH, how is obesity not true for the 49 other states? How is addiction not true for the 49 other states? How is depression not true for the 49 other states? Whatever is going on here makes no sense, given the fact that we have so much in a positive way going for us. We have wealth. We have opportunity. We have low unemployment. We spend more actually per capita on health care than almost any other state in the nation. When you look at all the positives, there is no explaining how we had the highest percentage increase. There is no explaining.
The article I haven't read it yet.
They could not unpack it. All right. Speaking of unpacking, though, I need to unpack my guests. Joining us right now from Rhode Island College is Val Endres. She's a professor of political communication. Welcome back to the program, Val.
Thank you. Great to be back.
It's a pleasure. We also have joining us from the great state of New Hampshire, Mark Fernald. Mark Fernald is a former Democratic candidate for governor. He is an attorney, and he is definitely a Democratic activist. And I have to put him on record as he has now endorsed Mayor Pete. So just in case we have a conversation about 2020, I want to at least put people in the proper silo. Welcome back to the program, Mark.
Thank you. Good to be here.
All right. So I sent a tweet out to all of you this morning because I've been listening to the hearings. And I realized that it's really important that we understand that the reason why there appears to be a lot of confusion and why people can't agree on the facts is that both Congress and the president claim that they care about corruption in Ukraine. But Val, I suddenly realized as I was listening to the hearings, here is the difference between Congress's concern about corruption in Ukraine and the president's concern. They spell it differently. You see, Congress spells corruption C-O-R-R-U-P-T-I-O-N, and Donald Trump spells it B-I-D-E-N. And that is, I almost wish that I could have a commercial saying that. That is the difference. They both claim they care about corruption, but one has a very, very limited and focused, you know, view of corruption, and it isn't even about cleaning it up. It's just about mentioning the name, Val. Oh, my God. We're living in la-la land. Val?
Yeah, exactly. But I have a little bit of a different take on it in that I think Joe Biden could go a long way by being clearer about Hunter's role in the Ukraine and talking about this more honestly. And, you know, I listened to the NPR interview this morning where he claimed that any talk about Hunter takes the eyes of the nation off of Donald Trump. You know, but it was Obama who said that both he and the electorate can walk and chew gum at the same time. So
exactly.
I really don't think that that argument holds water. But, you know, we have talked about this before on the radio. There was an issue about Hunter's involvement in the Ukraine. And that needs to be fully unpacked, and he has the opportunity to educate the electorate rather than go on the defensive, thinking that that's going to ruin his chances in the presidential race. And so I think that fuels, you know, Trump's people and his base and Trump himself to make these wild claims while Biden shuts down at the same time.
Well, let me just say something, Mark. I think I understood that in October of this year, Hunter Biden said he probably made a mistake and shouldn't have done it. So out of the mouth of Hunter is coming the confession or the rationalization or the realization that he shouldn't have done it. And in a lot of ways, it kind of gives his dad a pass. If his dad wants to protect Hunter, Hunter's already said, ugh, you know? I mean, that's part of it. I don't understand where the communication gap is between father and son. I mean, that really is my problem. If he can't talk to Hunter, how can he talk to the rest of us, Mark?
I'm surprised that Biden has come out and said, well, I really would have wished that Hunter hadn't taken that position. It certainly, you know, doesn't look right. You know, it doesn't look as though Hunter Biden got the job on the board of Burisma because he was an expert in natural gas transmission.
I know.
Maybe Biden could say that and then move on. But, I mean, go back to the issue of corruption where you were saying, how do you spell it? I mean, when Ambassador Yovanovitch testified and she said the amount looted by the previous president and his cronies was estimated to be $40 billion. I almost drove the car off the road.
I
couldn't believe the amount of money that's been looted from Ukraine through corruption. So it's obviously a huge issue, and hopefully they're digging their way out of it, but Hunter Biden's not part of any of that.
Well, let me just say something. So, Dean, as we're sort of – we'll shut this sort of Hunter Biden story down. But Biden just went on the record that if he became president, none of his children or the, or related family members would be able to do basically what Hunter did.
So except he doesn't have the power to prevent that. Remember Billy Beer? I mean, Jimmy Carter couldn't control Billy.
Well, I get that, but this is different. That's a brother. This is a son. I mean, I really do. But isn't it interesting? He's gone on the record going forward about this. His son has gone on the record saying, I shouldn't have done it. But still, he doesn't know how to close the door or do the explaining he needs to do. Mm-hmm. He's afraid to even talk about it. And now the excuse is, I really wasn't aware because my son was dying. And I feel let me bring Dean in.
Sure.
Because Dean, here's my problem, is that now we find out that with Joe Biden, his middle name is Excuse. Now, let me just say something. So we now know that part of the reason why he doesn't seem to perform well in certain debates is that he was a stutterer. And now we're told that the reason why he didn't realize what Hunter was doing was because Beau was dying. Both those things are true. Both those things are tragedies. But at some point in time, I think you have to owe the fact that you are wearing a position of authority, that a lot of people are depending on you, and yet I understand the family issues and the personal issues, but you have to figure out how you protect us as well.
Yeah, you know, it's not clear to me that even without the tragedy of his son Beau dying, that he necessarily would have said or done anything. It's you know, his response so far has been, I had nothing to do with it. He's an adult. He can make his own decisions. You know, you saw the problem with that, though, this weekend when he had the back and forth with that voter. That voter said, you know, the information that voter is getting is, you set your son up in that job. because you were vice president and they wanted to curry favor with the Obama administration. So that's the kind of misinformation he has to deal with. So he needs a better, more focused answer to this. They seem to be very, very slowly and trudgingly moving in that direction. It's not going to go away. If you watched even a sampling of Republican response on the weekend shows, it's all about Ukrainian corruption in the 2016 election. And, you know, Biden and the Obama administration in some way will eventually get, if not already, get mixed into that, fair or not. Right. So it's not going to go away. Simply saying he had nothing to do with it, but Hunter's an adult. It's not a winning response for him, and
no,
so
it's not.
Either is getting angry about it. You got to have it.
Let me just say something. If his son is an adult, here's what I do. I go on the record with Barack Obama at a press conference saying I do not approve of this decision by my son.
Yeah, it was a bad idea.
He does it at the time.
I understand why it doesn't look good. It's a bad idea.
Exactly.
He shouldn't have done it.
Exactly.
I had nothing to do with it. It's just not a sufficient. Doesn't mean that he did anything illegal or corrupt, but you have to have a better response.
Let me just ask
one
question.
What? A lot of us said that at the time, Dean, on this show.
In what time?
You and us and everybody at the time.
They needed a better response. Yes,
came out.
Yes,
that
it's not
going to
go away.
Could have just said exactly that.
Yeah,
and it would have gone
but,
away.
But let me just say this. So, Mark, let me just say one thing though. What I think is also interesting is the Republicans controlled the House for a year or two before the Democrats took over in 2018. If they were so worried about Ukraine and they were so worried about corruption and they were so worried about Biden, boy, they had lots and lots of months to do a lot of stuff. They were doing whatever they wanted to do. They could have done it. How come the Republicans didn't do anything when they were in power?
Excellent question.
Thank you. Oh, my God. I mean, it just kills me. It's like the only – I mean, they're such puppy dogs. They're lap dogs. That's what they are. It is truly shocking. So, Val, as we move forward on this, you see this back and forth that they're going too quickly. No, they should be – you know, they should slow it down, or they should – you know, they should get this over by the end of the week or whatever. And knowing that basically the Senate is going to rubber stamp whatever Donald Trump wants because of Mitch McConnell – does it matter quick or slow, fast or lethargic? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out, does any of that matter? Is this basically a way for them to say, we did our due diligence, we did what we needed to do as patriots, we did not do what we needed to do for the purposes of politics? This is not a political calculation because it may not help us. It may not hurt us, but it may not help us. We're doing this because we feel like we need to do this, because if we don't act on this, God forbid what happens going into the future.
Well, and I think that's absolutely correct. That and then that's what brought, I think, Nancy Pelosi to the realization that she has no choice but to move toward impeachment, because it would set a very dangerous precedent for the future. But on the other hand, too, I think Pelosi is right in that she doesn't want this to leak into the 2020 election. And so getting it finished efficiently may be her strategy to be done with this and then move on to the campaign itself. And I think she's right. And I think that will be the reason why impeachment probably is going to be more narrowly defined than a lot of Democrats would actually want.
So there is an article, Mark, at The Hill, and Dean, I want you to weigh in this as well. Senate braces for a brawl on Trump impeachment rules. Now, I understand what Nancy Pelosi wants to control, but guess who controls when it goes over to the Senate? Mitch McConnell. I can't even imagine the kind of crazy quilt he wants to sort of make. So the problem with Mitch is he can decide if it's going well for me, I'm going to drag it out. If it's not going well for me, I'm going to shut it down. I mean, it's like there is no ability to control, because Mitch McConnell doesn't care about process. He doesn't really care about impeachment. He's just constantly playing the calculation of the politics and how it will serve him for 2020. Am I right about this, Mark?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Actually, I have a question for the panel. Maybe someone knows this. There's been all this talk about what if they did a secret ballot vote in the Senate? You know, would some Republicans vote to impeach? Is that actually a possibility? That's my question.
Oh, I don't know, and I don't think so. What I also
want the speculation, but I don't know how they break Senate rules to do that.
Oh, they simple. It's a majority. If it's a Senate rule, then the Senate by the majority could vote to actually change the rules. So rules have no meaning. So
no, I think they need a 2/3 vote to change the rules. That's the difficult thing about the Senate rules.
Is it 2/3? But there's something about them. We were talking to Dave Schultz, who's a professor from Hamline University, and they can actually thread the needle and still get to a majority, even though they need 2/3. It is absolutely correct. Well, my big question is that Dean Spiliotis, what about the possibility of censure? Could they get to the point where they're about to write the articles of impeachment and then say, you know what, let's just censure him? I mean, could they do that?
How do you think Trump would react to that?
I think it would. Well, who gives
That's going to be a non-starter. And, unless something fundamentally changes in the dynamics of how the Republican Party has responded to him thus far, to suddenly say, oh, you know, we're going to censor you when we know he believes it was the perfect call and he did nothing wrong. And Republicans control they get to set the rules in the same way that Democrats set the rules in the House.
Yep.
We're all kind of waiting to see how McConnell's going to game this out. There are a number of different options that we've alluded to. But it's going to, they're talking about calling, Hunter Biden and Joe Biden and Adam Schiff. And, it's going to be... who knows? So other people, there's all kinds of characters that have been on the periphery of the story that they could try to bring in. I think we know with Trump that a lot of what he says sometimes is bluster. I'm going to do X, Y, or Z, or I really want to testify. I'm going to come and testify. And, in the end, he's not going to come and testify.
Right. If he can't tweet it, he won't do it.
But, Dean, why does it matter if Trump and the Republicans don't want it? Couldn't the Democrats just do that instead of impeaching now?
Do which? Censure? They could do whatever they want in the House. It just wouldn't go through the – wouldn't.
Yeah,
go
but
the
censure
Senate.
Ends it.
Censure in the House.
Because if you don't write articles of impeachment, if you – like you start the articles and then on Friday they decide, you know what? We're gonna vote to say exactly. It doesn't trigger the trial, and so it ends there with a censure.
No, they're never gonna do that.
All right, well,
they'll never do that because it's come down to a matter of principle. They had the constitutional scholars, and I don't remember their names, but the woman who testified just put it all in a sentence. She said or two, and she said, in the future, let's assume some state has a natural disaster. The governor calls the president and says, I need a disaster declaration and I need help from the federal government. And the president's response is, yeah, but first I need you to do me a favor. I need you to start and have your attorney general start investigating Senator so-and-so who's running against me for president next year.
So let me just say something. He's almost doing that with California now. Remember with the fires and stuff? I mean, I hate to say this. He hasn't necessarily done the complete quid pro quo. He just doesn't like California. So he drags his knuckles on responding or suggesting that they waste their money or they don't rake the forest. Oh, my God. This guy is so crazy. All right. We need to end this conversation right now. This is our Rethink the Week. We have Val Endres. We have Mark Fernald. And we have Dean Spiliotis. A Little Labor News is next. And then we will be back with The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1958. That was the day 12 ultra-conservatives, including Robert Welch, Fred Koch, and Harry Lynn Bradley, gathered in Indianapolis to found the John Birch Society. These men saw cabals and communist conspiracies everywhere. They mobilized their vast financial resources to fuel Cold War paranoia. They opposed New Deal policies, the Civil Rights Movement, Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs, and the Equal Rights Amendment. They funded Barry Goldwater's presidential bid in 1964, denounced Richard Nixon as a fake, and warned of his establishment of diplomatic ties with China. The Birchers also opposed water fluoridation, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. They pressed for the U.S. to withdraw from the United Nations and viewed the U.S. war in Vietnam as a plot to bring communism to the United States. Welch, a candy manufacturer, even asserted that President Dwight David Eisenhower was simply a tool for the communists and an advocate of a one-world new order. More recently, many Birchers have also helped to found and fund the National Right to Work Committee, whose legal defense arm has pushed hard for anti-union legislation. Prominent members like the Koch brothers have funneled millions into the National Right to Work Committee in order to bust unions, kill the Employee Free Choice Act, and weaken the regulatory authority of the National Labor Relations Board. Their current headquarters are in Appleton, Wisconsin, hometown of Red Scare warrior Senator Joseph McCarthy.
Well, I run down most hurriedly and joined the John Birch Society. Got me a secret membership card, started walking off down the road. Oh boy, I'm a real John Bircher now. Look out, you're
Labor
coming.
History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. For 70 years, visitors to Cape Cod's Nauset Beach could wander up to a seaside clam shack when they got hungry. When John Ullman bought the business in 1989, he named it Liam's after his son.
It was such an iconic place. You would walk up to Liam's in your bathing suit and get great seafood and then go back to the beach.
But with ongoing erosion made worse by rising seas and increasingly intense storms, the ocean began to threaten the clam shack. Ullman says the beach was shrinking by about 3 feet a year. Then in 2018, a winter storm hit hard.
Within 13 hours, two high tide cycles, the beach was entirely gone and there were 20-foot waves hitting the clam shack.
After the storm,
it was hanging over a cliff, essentially, with no sand left in front of it, no sand left underneath it.
The town of Orleans, Massachusetts, which owned the building, decided it did not make sense to rebuild. It demolished Liam's and in its place built a sand dune to protect the shore. Ullman says Liam's was one of thousands of Cape Cod properties now at risk from climate change. But to him, it was one of a kind.
It was a wonderful place to go to work every day. It's a very difficult family loss, profound family loss.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Hypocrites, better watch out. I think this should be our theme song for this show. This is called The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Producer Ken Barnes picks our music. People know who sings this. Even I know who sings
this. This is Jimmy Cliff.
God, I love it.
The great Jimmy Cliff.
And, terrific.
There's so many hypocrites out there.
That's right.
Who knows who this is dedicated to?
Under letter A, under letter B. All right, everyone. Oh, speaking of A and B, Sesame Street, Big Bird died.
Oh.
Yeah, so sad. All right, let me tell you who's on our Rethink the Week. Joining us in studio is Dean Spiliotis. He's a civic scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. Joining us by phone is Val Endres. She is a political communications professor at Rhode Island College. And Mark Fernault is a former Democratic state senator, a former candidate for governor, as well as an attorney and an activist. So, hypocrites. So you can almost go anywhere with that one. I'm going to start with you, Mr. Fernault. And, you know, Bloomberg has entered the race, and we now know that, you know, so far he spent $55 million, and he can spend up to probably $1 billion and not even feel it, because he's worth between $54 and $55 billion. But what's so interesting is Bloomberg enters the race. He's going to just spend oodles and boodles of money. And now we're suddenly seeing money and transparency being the conversation between, for example, Elizabeth Warren and Mayor Pete and, you know, all the other candidates. It's so to me, it's interesting. It's like he's peeled off the money scab, and there's really nothing you can say about him except he's got a lot of it. But now we're sort of slicing and dicing the other 2020 candidates, and we're making them somehow not good on the money thing. Where are you bundling from? What are you doing with this? So what do we take at this? Shouldn't we be focusing on Bloomberg and Steyer instead?
What I think is going on with Bloomberg, and I could be all wrong, is that he's not signing up for any of the first four contests.
Right.
So he's waiting to see if Sanders or Warren are running away with it at that point. And maybe other people have dropped out for lack of money or whatever. And I think that if Bloomberg thinks that the moderates have all failed, he's in with both feet and $1 billion. But I think if it's Biden, if it's Buttigieg, if it's Klobuchar, I wouldn't be surprised if he says, you know, okay. I'm okay.
Val, what do you think of that analysis? That's very interesting. So he creates the illusion like he's in. He's talking about all this stuff. He's gagging a Bloomberg News so that his reporters can't actually cover the 2020. Boy, they must be ticked off. Do you think that that's really what he's doing? Is he sort of he's playing the odds?
He probably is, but I doubt whether a surge of Mayor Pete or Klobuchar is going to cause him to drop out of the race. I just don't think that's going to happen. He spent $37 million already on blanket carpet bombing with ads, and I think he's in it. I think he really believes that he can go head to head with any of the candidates. He's a pretty confident person. Some may say that he's awfully arrogant about this, but I don't think a scare. I do believe that he thinks that he can run away with it. And remember, he still isn't going to face the scrutiny of the debate. So he gets to control the message,
totally,
except for an occasional interview. And Mayor Pete nor Klobuchar have that, or Biden have that privilege.
Well, let me just say something, Dean. As I'm listening to Val talk about, he's already spent, you know, 35, 55, mm-hmm, whatever it is. I hate to break it up. He could spend $1 billion and decide to pull out. He's got so much money that, you know, you and I are thinking, wow, that's a lot of money. There's a lot of commas in those checks, you know? I mean, that's how we're thinking. He doesn't even know what a comma looks like. He doesn't care about commas. So he can, pardon the expression, I'm going to use a bad word, he can piss it away, basically as he's testing the waters with the illusion that he's doing something, and he could decide, all right, I can leave now, or I can put my support in for someone else.
He has the luxury to wait until after Super Tuesday.
Completely,
for sure. So you got, 14 or 16 states on Super Tuesday,
exactly,
something like that.
Exactly.
See how it goes.
Exactly.
And then mid-March, you can make a decision whether to continue or not.
And he's not letting anyone down but his accountant. You know, I mean, it's like
and all the press that works for him.
Well, and that's the other thing. Can we talk a little
bit
about this
story?
That is a really interesting story. I'm trying to figure out how. So here's what my problem. I read what the executive editor said at Bloomberg News, basically saying that, you know, we've told our reporters you can't cover Bloomberg and you can't cover the other Democrats in the 2020, but you can cover Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the license. You can go after the Donald, but not everybody else. Well, if that's true, I read a story at Bloomberg about one of the candidates the other day, and it was about a 2020 candidate. So I'm looking at this story and I'm going, wait a minute, what's real here? Are they basically not? Are they ignoring their boss? Are they about to sacrifice their paycheck? I'm just trying to figure that out. Did you see that story, Val? There was a story.
I did. Yeah, so explain to me.
And I
you were right to point up that irony. So what actually is the policy? Because
exactly.
I saw, and I looked online, and I saw absolutely no follow-up to that.
Yep.
But I think what's so troubling here is that he's taking away from the freedom of the press because he's the owner. And he's certainly said that as well, that I'm the boss, you know, you're going to have to follow these rules, rather than to allow them to report on both he and the other candidates. And I think this sets a very dangerous precedent for the press.
Well, let me just say something. So, Mark, okay, so they have a license to cover the president, right? But they can't cover the 2020. But what if the president talks about Joe Biden? What if the president talks about Pocahontas? What if the president talks about the socialist Bernie Sanders? It's the president. It's coming out of his mouth. He's going to be focusing on 2020. He's going to want to pick and choose who's going to run against him. How do you cover the president and not cover the 2020 candidates? I'm just sorry. How the hell do you thread that needle, Mark?
I don't know. Of course, on the other hand, if he turns his reporters loose, then how do they escape the claim anytime they do a hard-hitting piece on somebody other than Bloomberg, that they're just carrying his water, you know, he's the paymaster, and therefore everything they write is discounted.
I have an answer. You want to know what my answer is? Sell Bloomberg News. Sell Bloomberg? No. Why isn't he doing that?
Or
he doesn't
put it in trust.
Or, well, put it in a blind trust, but more, I think, better than that, why doesn't he get rid of it? I mean, think about that, Dean. That is the answer. He doesn't need them anymore, technically. I mean, he's getting old anyway. He's running for president. That's the last hurrah. I mean, after that, what is he going to do, run for Pope? He can't. He's Jewish. So I'm just I'm serious here. Why doesn't he sell it so that he can look squeaky clean as opposed to being the master puppeteer?
It strikes me as he's going to hedge his bets on it. I don't think he would do that. I saw an interview over the weekend. I think it was with Gayle King of CBS where, you know, he basically said, look, they you know, it's a job. They get paychecks. And sometimes that's just how it is. I mean, he really has just decided that this is the way it's going to be. Now, how it plays out in practice with all of these kinds of gray areas that you're suggesting, I mean, I guess that's an editorial decision. But he doesn't seem to have any real compunction about laying down the law on this.
So we have to talk about the shooting at the Navy base. We have to talk about this. So, Mark, the shooting is horrific. The fact that, you know, these guys are brought in, he was there for 2 years, and then he goes around and he gets a gun on himself and he kills these three soldiers. So my concern is that these horrific things do happen. It's beyond comprehension. My concern is how President Trump responds. What if it had been someone who was from a military base from Mexico who was there for 2 years studying? How do you think Donald Trump would have responded versus the Saudis? This is just – he's so obvious. He's so obvious. Everyone is expendable. Everyone, including how he responded to what happened at this naval base. Mark?
I don't know about the president's response. It seems to me that if you're cozied up to the NRA, you don't really have a response other than the response we've heard sort of before from some people not quite as high up as Trump, but it's just like, well, these things happen. But, you know, we can't restrict people's completely 100% rights to access any gun anywhere at any time, so we'll just have to live with it. I mean, that's basically the NRA line, and it's the president's line.
But don't you think he gave the Saudi prince a real pass? I mean, it was almost covering for him. That's the part makes me crazy.
And that this is part of the reason why I think it's so important that we eventually see his tax returns and understand what kinds of business interests that he has with the Saudi government, because he immediately responded with support for them and didn't talk about it being an act of terrorism. And I'm sure that there's self-interest involved there, but we need to know the extent of
it. Well, isn't it interesting? Wait, let me, Dean, think about this. How does he talk about DACA kids? He talks about, well, they've been here for a long time, and some of them are really corrupt. And he goes on to sort of suggest that these kids who have absolutely unblemished records.
Some of them are really bad, he says.
Real bad things, But look what he did with the Saudi prince, and look at how he immediately forgave, protected, defended. Everything went through a lens of forgiveness and understanding. He shows none of that.
It's a lens of self-interest.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What makes sense for him. And he's clearly shown an affinity for having these closer relationships with the authoritarian governments. And it's very clear to him that given his base, the DACA kids, the whole aspect of immigration is a losing issue for him. So he's going to hit back against it. But yeah, I remember just pretty recently he said, those DACA kids, a lot of them are actually really bad people.
Exactly.
Kind of, which is just, you know, completely created
out of thin air.
Thin air, right.
And yet out of thin air, he basically gives the Saudis a complete pass before he knows anything. And he's forgiving them. Mm-hmm. And we have to put.
As he did with the murder of the journalist.
Exactly.
Well.
Exactly. Exactly. It's just, to me, it's so shocking when you do a split screen. I'm waiting for the Democrats to do a split screen, you know, to point to how quickly he is ready to condemn, whether it's based on any kind of fact or not, and how quickly he's ready to forgive and embrace when people are dead, you know, at a military base. It's just it's kind of surprising. All right, I need to talk about this because I've been talking about this for a long time, and that is that Mark, New Hampshire is the exception to the rule, but it is not uncommon for states to bend over backwards to get corporations to come to their state. They will give them free property taxes for 10 years. They'll give them other kinds of tax breaks. They will basically, you know,
Free infrastructure improvements.
Yeah, free infrastructure improvements. And in the end, you have to start asking a question, was it worth it? Well, the more shocking thing was when AOC was so upset about the amount of investment, quote unquote, New York was prepared to make in the richest man in the world, who owns probably the most successful company in the world, in order to get some jobs from Amazon. Well, you saw the headline, AOC Sanders say, I told you so, as Amazon and Facebook come to New York City. I think I want to buy the billboard on Times Square with this. Well, actually, my problem is I would have my middle fingers up in the air in stereo. But this story is so interesting, and yet it's a story that should be told to every state in the nation that basically does this. And when you do the cost-benefit analysis, it is very rare that the states actually get their money or their investment back, Mark.
It's true. I mean, and New Hampshire is a good example that we don't do that. We've never done it. And we've been the fastest growing state in the Northeast for decades.
Yeah.
So you don't need to do it.
Yeah. It's Amazon's. Listen to this, everyone. On Friday, just want you to take the math down. On Friday, Amazon signed a lease for 335,000 square feet of space in the Hudson Yards neighborhood. Enough space for more than 1,500 workers. The largest U.S. e-commerce company said it wasn't getting tax benefits or other incentives. I mean, how do you – you know what this is? This is the AOC reelection. Because I think there was a target on AOC's back for 2020, because she won by a very small margin, and that was because the incumbent basically was asleep at the switch and never thought that this would happen. And who was she anyway? And she had no money. And I actually think that this is something that she and frankly Bernie do sort of ride into the sunset, because it proves that, you know, it's not that you don't want the jobs, you don't want to have to pay a wealthy company so that they can get even wealthier by giving them more money for creating the jobs that they need, Dean Spiliotis.
Yeah, but, you know, we know the reality. And, you know, I remember this many years ago when I used to live in Chicago. And Chicago was always trying to either attract big businesses or keep them from leaving. And there were always debates about, you know, what kind of concessions to make. And, you know, politically, it's very important to show that you're attracting businesses and creating jobs. And, you know, getting these high-profile deals is something that politicians like to have that feather in their cap. But a lot of times when you look at the reality of the cost over time, it turns out to be not as good of a deal as you might have once thought. So this is a very interesting development.
Well, but Val, as someone did send me a note, and they said, now remember, Arnie, initially Amazon had a plan to bring about 25,000 workers.
Correct.
This is only 1,500. But I have a funny feeling, Val, it's going to be 1,500 this year and 1,500 next year, because they need to be in New York.
Well, also the promises that these large corporations make, and this has been the history in Rhode Island, and that's what stopped some of the statewide subsidies for them, is that they seldom actually meet their employment goals. That's one thing.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I think is worth watching is Representative Cicilline from Rhode Island, who is taking on the large tech corporations like Amazon, Google, and Facebook. And he's chair of the subcommittee that's overseeing antitrust laws.
Right.
So one of the things that's happening is that when you are, you know, too big to fail and you offer these subsidies, there's almost just a compulsion that you have to say yes to these large corporations. And that's part of the reason why I think taking a second look at antitrust laws become even more important,
right,
so that they're not holding individual states hostage.
So let me say something, Mark. One of the rationales from Donald Trump with his brilliant tax cut plan of 2017 was that this money was going to be used to raise salaries, and this money was going to be used for capital investment. We found out in 2018 that they actually produced less capital investment than they had before the tax cuts, and that they basically were using, you know, buybacks, and it wasn't going into salaries, it wasn't going into capital investment, it was going into the hands of management and shareholders, all right? So part of my problem is that how do you justify you know, basically buying Amazon's jobs at the same time giving them a tax cut. I mean, it's like how much more can you shower on corporate America as you drain the money that's needed for healthcare, that's needed for infrastructure, that's needed to address the debt, that's needed to address climate change? How can you, we keep paying them and paying them to get richer and richer and to demand more and more as if we can live on air? That's the part that I don't get. They just got this huge tax cut. Why would you ever give them another penny?
The corporate tax cut was just another form of trickle-down, which has been shown over and over not to work. I guess the other interesting point to take from all this is going back to, I guess I would say, the Republicans' aversion to science, which is based on facts. Well, the fact of the matter is that all of the Republican tax cuts since Reagan have not produced what was promised, and yet Republicans continue to believe in it because it's religion to them. It's not science. It's not fact-based.
Well, what's religion to Democrats, Dean Spiliotis? Dean, they want to be Republicans. What is the attack on Elizabeth Warren? It's not just the wealth tax. It's about all the other things that, you know, it's going to cost you. As if we can get health care without taxing someone. As if we can address climate change without paying for it. The Democrats are so desperate to sound like Republicans because it is like one side is articulate and does the math and explains it and holds people's hands and says, you really need this tax. I mean, the problem is both of them want to promise the sun, the moon, and the stars, and say you're going to get it for nothing. I mean, isn't that part of our problem? I mean, I'm kind of curious here as to how you move forward with this enormous deficit that we've just created and these enormous costs that we are facing going forward. How do you do both? Ask the American people, how do you do both?
Well, but the issue of debts and deficit no longer seems to be of particular concern to anybody, Republicans or Democrats. Everybody's just kind of accepted that we're going to run these trillion-dollar deficits and debt, into the future. It becomes almost kind of make-believe at some point. It's hard to even conceptualize of what we actually owe and the rate at which it grows. You know, but this issue that you're talking about Democrats want to sound like Republicans. I think this race now, we're coming up on almost a year since Elizabeth Warren officially kind of jump-started it. I think it was right before New Year's where she got into the race. Mm-hmm. You know, it's fascinating for me to watch kind of the progressives have been kind of ascendant for a good chunk of the year. But in the last month or so, we've now within the party, the Democrats have gotten into this debate over, taxes and what's affordable and what's realistic and what can be done. And you sort of have felt the steam kind of, subside a little bit. And so now the party is in the middle of this debate over that. I don't know how it's going to be resolved.
Yeah.
But I think my sense is moderates or, sort of non-progressives in the party who felt on their back on their heels and defensive in the spring now feel a little
coming
more
out of the telephone booth.
Yeah, Biden is swinging
here
a little harder. Buttigieg is, making tactical moves. Klobuchar speaking a little louder.
Yep.
I don't have an answer for you, but I think it's less clearer now than ever. Really.
And actually, you know what they're doing? They're pointing to Kamala. The end of Kamala's campaign, everyone, is because Kamala never quite figured out what her lane was.
She started
with the progressive lane, then she went to the other lane.
And
the fact that Kamala has pulled out, Val, is, I think, from the more moderate perspective, going, see, she screwed up by starting in that progressive lane, and then she kept vacillating, and therefore she had no message for anyone. But here's what I'm seeing. I'm not seeing that it's a fight between moderates and progressives. I'm seeing that it's Bernie versus Elizabeth now, and now it's Buttigieg versus Biden. That they're now, that's where the competition is. Biden is kind of looking at Buttigieg like, he's younger, he's more articulate, he doesn't have a Hunter problem, all those kinds of things. He doesn't have any record like I do on, the criminal justice bill and all those other things. And now you're seeing that, the progressives are now eating up Elizabeth Warren and spitting her out because she's not as perfect as Bernie. Am I right here? I'm beginning to see that happening.
Well, at some point, Democrats are going to have to see which of those two pairs is going to.
Well, that's what I'm saying. At some point, it's going to come down to maybe one and one.
Yeah, but it's fascinating.
It's fascinating
to see how they're dividing up. Val?
But a way that the progressives, I think, could make some substantial moves is by talking about what you had just indicated, that the middle class does have to be taxed on these programs. And when I've interviewed, for example, physicians on Medicare for All, one of the things that they say with the overspending in our healthcare system right now is because people don't feel as if they have any skin in the game.
Right.
And that's the same for climate change, too. And they believe that if people were taxed more for their own health care and it just wasn't seen as part of their employee plan for the people who have very generous employee plans, that they would start paying attention to the cost and they would start valuing it more. And I think that there is that sense of the aversion that we get ourselves into debt by government overspending without having individual citizens take responsibility for the program.
So let me,
and then, if they didn't like that program, they would vote. You know, they would get out there and vote for it. So there is a sense that I think Elizabeth Warren is, when she backed away where she had a prime opportunity
to explain,
to move us in that direction, and she didn't do it.
Yeah, the fear factor came in. I think her staff or her consultants told her not to go there, and she should never listen to consultants. That's all I have to say. So let me end this conversation really quickly, because, Mark, as I'm hearing all this, one of the things I keep thinking about is that not only are we afraid to do the math for the American people, but, you know, it's kind of like I want to put solar panels on my roof. It's going to cost me $30,000. But if I know that my utility bill over the course of the next couple of months and next couple of years is going to be one half or one third, was it worth spending the $30,000? Some people are having to look at this thing with health care and seeing if I pay a tax for health care, but I don't have an out-of-pocket, you know, deductible of $5,000. I don't have to pay a copay of 20%. And if I don't have to go bankrupt, is it worth that $200 a month in additional taxes? And nobody ever does the math with the American people that way. Never.
Right.
And I have to let you guys go. Anyway, this is Rethink the Week. Dean Spiliotis, Val Endres,
thanks,
Mark
Ernie.
Fernald, thank you so much for joining us. How do we end our show, Ken Bond?
We end with a hopeful song, Change is Going to Come by the Neville Brothers. I thought the discussion would end a little more hopefully than it ended.
We're going to do the math. Here we go.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Just like the river I've been running ever since. Oh, it's been a long, long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. It's been but I'm afraid to die, 'cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. Oh, it's been a long, long, long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. Say, brother, help me, please.
What would I come to? Obviously,
but he winds up
resources, and we want to make
nothing made.